This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Arab Spring began a wave of protests and revolutions across North Africa and the Middle East. The convulsions that began about 5 years ago were a long time in the making, though they seemed to happen all at once. UNC Professor Andrew Reynolds found himself in the midst of the fighting. He was in that part of the world to advise the transitional governments on how to set up and structure new elections. He spent time in Egypt, Libya, and Yemen, working for the United Nations and the U.S. National Security Council. After returning to the U.S., Andy co-wrote a book called The Arab Spring, Pathways of Repression and Reform. Andy's a political science professor at UNC Chapel Hill and joins me in the studio now. Andy Reynolds, it's good to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
I want to talk a lot about the Arab Spring, but let's get a little bit of your background first. You didn't start out in the Middle East. Tell me a little bit about your career as an advisor. Where did it begin?
Well, I actually really got engaged in politics as a teenager in London, in South London, and for some bizarre reason, I became particularly interested in the American civil rights movement and in South Africa and in what was happening under apartheid in South Africa. There was no great reason to that because I was in a very white suburban area of South London, but those issues resonated with me. And after a number of years, after being in college in Britain and working for a couple of years, I then ended up going to the University of Cape Town in 1991, and I went to study the new constitution as it was being written and had a fabulous eye-on-the-wall experience at that incredibly tumultuous time. And then after finishing my master's degree, I began to get asked to go to other places and tell them about the experiences that South Africa had had trying to put together a new constitution. So my first job for the UN was in Sierra Leone in 1995, and that was at the same time I was doing my PhD on Southern Africa, South Africa, Malawi, Zambia, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and I was working in California doing my PhD there. But I got to travel and begin to take those experiences to new places that were going through a similar experience.
Were you studying the kind of the transition in post-apartheid South Africa when you were there? Was that the focus?
Yeah, so my master's was on the choice of election system for the new constitution, which turned out to be a really critical factor in assuring minority groups that they had a voice within the new dispensation. If they'd used the old whites-only system, the ANC would have won an easy two-thirds majority in the new assembly. And that would have allowed them to write the new permanent constitution by themselves. And even Mandela said that we don't want the responsibility of being able to shut every other voice out from the new dispensation. And so they were trying to find new systems that would be appropriate to that new South Africa that wanted to reach out to black and white, colored and Indian, different regional groups, and not just be a majoritarian system.
This really reveals an interesting aspect of any kind of nation building where you really have to be conscious of, and you can never not be conscious of, the outcome. As you're constructing the system, it's pretty easy to at least imagine what outcome you would get under System A and how things would be different under System B. And so, I mean, the question of whether or not you're engineering outcomes by sort of making the system is an interesting one, and it seems to be the challenge for people who are trying to construct any form of government.
I mean, I think it's a little like medical diagnosis in the sense that a doctor will look at a patient and try and use their best experience and knowledge to diagnose what is wrong with that patient and prescribe treatment. And if you think of a constitutional advisor as a doctor, what they need to do is find the right way of diagnosing what is wrong with that nation state. What really is the illness? Is it that groups are polarized against each other? Is it about money? Is it about some ancient power struggle? Sometimes on the surface, the illness looks very obvious. It's Sunni, Shia, Kurdish. Mm-hmm. But perhaps that's not really the underlying thing that ails society. And so a doctor, a constitutional designer, should then go in and say, okay, from my experience in other places, from my experience of other patients, what treatments would I recommend to you? Now, those treatments may not work. There may be other factors beyond the patient's control that doom the patient to failure. There may be new things that come up, but at the very least, we can't predict exactly how institutions are going to play out, but we can try and think about the experiences in similar types of places and times elsewhere.
Well, I want to talk more about that and that analogy you used, the medical one. I mean, in the medical analogy, we can assume that a human body is roughly the same and works the same way from one part of the globe to another, but you're analyzing here what's wrong with a country that has a cultural livelihood and a cultural biology, and you come at that from a different cultural history. How do you weigh your, like we'll call them prejudices and ideas about what's right with any society and what's wrong, given the cultural milieu you find yourself in?
Well, the first thing is that it's clearly self-evident that the leaders of choosing new structures for a state must be those citizens of the state. So anybody going in to advise needs to be very humble and very modest in their aspirations and really provide information for the domestic actors to work with that. Now, that being said, every state, every country is rightly going to say, we are Finland, or we are Lesotho, and we are different, we are distinct. No one looks like us. And that's half true, but it's also half not true, in the sense that the way in which a democracy or institutions may work in Syria actually has some resonance in Jordan. The way in which Papua New Guinea's structures work may have some resonance with Madagascar. There are lessons to be learned from other places. I think the way you approach culture is to, you try and structure new institutions, democratic institutions, elections, separation of powers, in a way that echoes and is rooted in traditional ways of working. The principles may be the same, but you choose those methods of choosing leaders or discussions that traditional African societies have used, or you echo, you sort of reflect the way that Latin Americans have done things. But sometimes you have to throw out some of the old that isn't productive anymore, that is not relevant. It's very macho. It's very antagonistic. It's very exclusionary to other voices. Maybe some of the old traditions aren't things you want to incorporate into the new. But at the same time, you have to cut the cloth to fit the body of that nation state. And the suit that fits one country is not going to fit another.
So tell us what you did in Sierra Leone.
Well, Sierra Leone was interesting, and I went in 95. It was a very tumultuous time. They had a 27-year-old dictator, military leader called Valentine Strasser. The UN sent me in to explain to the new political parties and the old parties in Sierra Leone how the new election system would work. And as a young sort of mid-20s person, I went in with, I suppose, a little of the arrogance that I knew everything about elections and I was going to tell these Africans how it was going to work. And it was the most wonderful experience because the very first meeting I addressed, which contained all the new political parties, and was to explain how the new system would work. I began by talking about different options and a hand shot up from the back. And an elderly Sierra Leonean political leader said to me, "Do you prefer John Stuart Mill's version of the single transferable vote or Thomas Hare's?" And it immediately hit me in the face that these people know much more about political history and theory and democratic design than I have ever picked up in my short time on this planet. They've been dealing with life in a democracy, a dictatorship for years, and they read and they're smart. And I was humbled by the level of knowledge in that room. They were political actors. They weren't warlords. They weren't military men. But again, the debate moved to a whole different level about how to work.
That does suggest some training and some education in Western circles, if you ask that question. And so then is there a divide when you're doing this kind of advising among those who have been Western trained and educated and those who have not?
Yeah. And I think that was very visible to me in Libya. I got the chance to go to Libya in September of 2011. I met with one civil society group of women, probably about 30 sort of fairly young women, all wearing the hijab or veils. And I gave my opening remarks, a discussion about democratic design in Libya. And then they began to speak, and they all had accents from Boston or Glasgow or from London. They had all been educated at the University of Edinburgh or MIT or Harvard, and they were smart and savvy, and they were coming back to their country, to Libya, to try and invest themselves and help with the transition. I mean, unfortunately, the story of that transition is that all of those voices have been lost. They had no significant role in the changes in Libya, but they had come back early on to try and make a difference.
You also, you were in Egypt after the government had overthrown Mubarak and his regime. The military was running things and trying to set up new elections. Talk about your experience there under those in that situation.
Well, Egypt was interesting because of the polarization between the bravery and the courage of the protesters, the Tahrir Square groups, the groups that came out of student groups and workers groups and intellectuals and thinkers. And on the other side, a military government and a military-backed government that was incredibly closed, incredibly non-transparent, incredibly hard to work out what their choices and decisions were. And I don't think I've ever been in a case, and I think this is reflected in the words of many of the people I worked with, where the internationals have been shut out more. They've had less access. And so we worked and were asked to work with any party and any civil society group that would come to us. And so we worked with not just the Coptic Christians, the Free Egyptians, the moderate Islamic groups, but we worked with the Muslim Brotherhood as well, and lots of civil society groups to think through how new structures could provide a new space in Egyptian politics for these new ideas. I went in June of 2011. I returned in September of 2011. After I got back to the States, the groups that I was working with, the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute and others, were raided by the Egyptian military police, and all their materials were taken. I was asked to return for a separate group at the end of 2011 to give a speech at the university, and I was told that I would be arrested if I returned. So purely for promoting democracy. So it was a very difficult situation and context to be involved in.
And I guess the other thing to point out, and just to talk about this whole business of being an advisor in these situations, you're not the only one. Are you working in teams or are you working in succession? They've talked to 30 or 40 of you. You're the 50th guy they've seen. How's it work?
There's actually not that many people who work on election system design. The competition is more for the ear of the actors who are making decisions. And you'll find that different countries will send advisors. So the Germans may send somebody, the British may send somebody, sometimes the French, sometimes the South Africans. And it's more the case of gaining the trust of local actors that you are, if not an impartial sounding board, you're somebody who is not there to impose your ideas and agenda upon them. And I find very quickly all of the actors will suck up information. I mean, the politicians want to learn as much about the rules of the game as they can, because clearly understanding the rules of the game is what gives them a leg up in the game. So, I mean, I'm rarely part of a team who work on elections, sometimes I'm part of a team, and this was with the Syrian opposition, that does constitutions, but everybody has their own little bailiwick, in the sense that there's the rule of law guy, and there's the woman who does security planning, and there's the woman who does economic redevelopment, and there's myself doing election system design. You get people with different specialties to go in, so a media person. And that's very useful because then we get some interplay between those groups.
What you do in your book, The Arab Spring, is to analyze both the protests, the results, and some of the conditions, because clearly we're talking about very different countries from place to place, very different outcomes. You mentioned Tunisia and Egypt, which were the first two that sort of entered the scene. Talk about the differences between the two. The Tunisian revolution happened relatively quickly and resulted in a kind of completion. Egypt took a little bit longer. You also rate that as complete. Maybe I'll have you talk about that, what you mean by that, and then we can talk more about other experiments in the region.
Well, the interesting comparison clearly between Tunisia and Egypt is that they went through a similar process at a similar time in 2011 as part of the Arab Spring. So the Tunisians, in very short order, overthrow their President Ben Ali. He flees the country, a civilian government comes in, the military step back, and a new constitutional is designed. And Tunisia, despite significant challenges, has done pretty well in holding elections, transferring power between two different governments, and if not consolidating democracy, completing a transition. So they've held two elections, government has changed hands, and it is still a electoral democracy. Now, Egypt, in the similar time period, protesters forced out President Mubarak. But in that case, what has happened is that Egypt has gone through a very short period of civilian rule under the Muslim Brotherhood. The military pulled the plug on that after about 11 months. They returned to power. They translated their military general into president, a civilian position, and all other voices were shut out of power. So it's really returned to a pretty repressive military dictatorship in Egypt, no matter how we like to dress it up. So it's gone in the opposite direction. And I think there's a number of different factors that explain that, but one of which is history, and one of which is culture, and one of which is the nature of what came before.
We'll talk about that. Let's take Tunisia. We're coming up to a break, but we can start with Tunisia. The kind of conditions, the way that institutions had been structured before, what kind of institutions were in place, and to what extent that played a role in what seems to be a smoother transition at this point.
Well, in the book that I did with Tariq Massoud from Harvard and Jason Brownlee from Texas at Austin, we actually wrote two books in 2012 and 13 and threw them both away because there was so much rapid change in the Middle East and the Arab world that we weren't getting a good handle on the big picture. And we were finally, by 2014, comfortable enough to say something, not the definitive word, but begin to step back and look at the trajectories of these places. And Tunisia just seemed to us to have all the right ingredients to give it the best chance to be stable, to be more democratic.
I tell you what, we'll take a break and we'll find out what those factors were and compare them to other nations as we talk today with Andy Reynolds, a political science professor at UNC Chapel Hill. His new book is The Arab Spring, Pathways of Repression and Reform, and our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Continue our conversation with Andy Reynolds, professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill and author of The Arab Spring, Pathways of Repression and Reform. So we're talking about ways in which Tunisia was different and has, at least in this moment, a kind of smoother pathway to transition. What were those conditions? What was unique about Tunisia?
Well, first, the military was always much more professional than surrounding militaries, in the sense that it wasn't solely tied to the ruling elite. It seemed to believe itself to be more of an institution that should stay out of politics. Not completely, but when Ben Ali was pushed, it didn't hold him up. The second thing about Tunisia is that it was lucky in having a Muslim Brotherhood, the Ennahda party, led by Rashid Ghannouchi, that was much more liberal, much more westernized, much more willing to do deals with secular parties, and much more had a higher propensity, I think, to look at national interest in the transition. And the third major area was that Tunisians were just historically involved in groups and organizations and unions and civil society groups. And they had been allowed to be. In many Arab world countries, civil society was shut down, was repressed. It was a meeting place that was a threat to the state. But in Tunisia, the union membership was relatively high. People met in sports clubs and singing clubs and religious groups. And so when the transition happened, there were communities that could appear and talk and discuss and put their input into the process. And so I think Tunisia, on all these different dimensions, just had a reservoir of individuals, of thinkers, of Democrats with a small d, who would be able to wrest the process away from the men with guns.
And the very existence of these groups with their various interests, but the fact that they're engaged suggests that there are multiple stakeholders, that there aren't just one or two at the top and then all the rest of us down here.
Right. And one of the interesting things about the democratic design in Tunisia is that some people will say, well, they chose really good inclusive institutions, and that's why the Tunisian experiment has succeeded. But what we would say and what we say in the book is that Tunisia did choose inclusive institutions, but they chose them because they had to. That was a reflection of the society, the people in the room. They needed to set up a dispensation that got every voice at the table because that was the nature of the mix of politics at the time.
And the point is that a lot of people, you can again point to this whole body of people, it's all the rest who are repressed, disenfranchised, and have plenty of reason to ask for inclusion. But if you're not engaged for whatever reason, if political repression may be it, but if you hadn't been engaged, then the idea of having a place at the table doesn't occur to anybody.
Right.
So, if you want to complete that thought or correct it, I'm happy to hear that. But I'd like to hear more about Egypt as well and contrast Egypt to Tunisia.
No, I think Egypt is useful to contrast and see how the process went much more differently and was much worse in that case, in the sense that it had the absence of all the positive factors of Tunisia. You know, the Egyptian military is vested, insinuated into every part of society and business and politics. The Egyptian military owns businesses. It's vested in the power structures and politics historically. It was never going to give up its political role because it was too much of a threat. And over the years, Egyptian presidents had suppressed civil society, had suppressed political opposition. There just wasn't a place for thinkers to meet and prepare and to organize. And when a dictator falls, you need people with an architectural map. They need plans because suddenly you have to work out a new world on the fly. And in Egypt, those plans, those people, those groups just didn't exist. They were cobbling together as they went. And very quickly, I think it was a three-cornered dance between the military, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the secular liberals. But then that dance became a dance between just the military and the Brotherhood. And then the military just decided they would dance alone.
And that's because the Brotherhood was better organized since they'd been at it for longer in opposition to... Is that right?
Well, yes. And it was interesting because in 2011, the Brotherhood was not that well organized, but he was much more organized than anybody else. So in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And we would go to party show and tells, and you'd leave those organizational meetings, those campaign appearances, and you'd say, well, I'd vote for the Brotherhood. Yeah. They're the most savvy. They're the most engaged. They're the most, you know, they speak the right campaign issues. People were polled in Egypt about what they wanted to see. And they didn't necessarily want to see democracy or liberalism or human rights. They wanted to see jobs and healthcare and education. They wanted the bread and butter issues that every voter around the world is interested in. And the people who said the right things to those voters, who talked about the economy, justice, healthcare, education, were the Muslim Brotherhood.
To what extent, you talked about being king in a particular context, to what extent do hereditary, you know, say monarchies, how would you contrast those with other dictatorships that are not hereditary? Is that a factor?
Very simply, it seems pretty clear that hereditary states, which are primarily monarchies, but we also include Assad's Syria, because of the way in which Assad, not just has the Assads have passed the presidency from father to son, but also the family and extended family has control of the security police, the military, and business. And the Gulf monarchies, Jordan, Morocco, other places, they seem to be less vulnerable to challenge. So they seem to be able to keep all the parts of the state on board with them that you need. You need to keep the military with you, the police with you, the security services with you. And hereditary monarchies and hereditary states like Syria seem to do a better job of that. If you don't have those tentacles everywhere, like in Tunisia or like in Libya, then you're less able to hold on. The military is more likely to defect. The businessmen won't fund you anymore. Mm. And that's what we saw in Libya and we saw in Tunisia.
But now, interestingly enough, if you compare the outcomes in Tunisia and Libya, you have very different outcomes, even though what you're talking about is the ability to hold on to power is easier in a hereditary state. The aftermath is not always the same. The Libyan experience is far different.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the thing about Libya is that it had no state before. You know, the state does things. It provides roads and it moves around mail and it provides education. But the state was almost non-existent in Libya because it was a fiefdom for a single man. Also, it was a historical jigsaw puzzle of three pre-colonial regions, you know, Cyrenaica, Tripolitania, and Fezzan, the east, west, and south, were three lumps of territory lumped together by colonial powers that had no real reason to be together. And so when you and Gaddafi fell because NATO and the West came in and made him fall. He wouldn't have fallen under our analysis if the West hadn't pushed him. In fact, when I went to Libya in September of 2011, I flew from Benghazi to Malta and then back to Tripoli. And Gaddafi was still on the run. The airport wasn't open. We were in a small UN plane. As we flew from Malta to Tripoli, the Mediterranean was entirely clear, blue skies. You see Tripoli along the coast. And the pilot leant back and said, "We're going to have to circle for traffic." And we're sort of bewildered. Traffic. This isn't Atlanta. I see no planes in the sky. The airport's not even open. And just at that moment, a French Mirage jet zoomed underneath us. And we all said, "That's fine. We can circle for traffic." Because NATO was bombing just south of Tripoli at the time. And Gaddafi was felled by foreign intervention. But what happened was that once he falls, the pressure cooker lid is taken off. The whole centrifuge is left to spin out of control, and everybody who runs a little village, a ward, with their guns, with their power, takes over. And so it just fragmented into the rule of the warlord in villages, and no one was ever really able to pull it back together to the center.
But interestingly enough, you point out that there was a kind of an electoral process that was developed and designed and executed, but it was that lack of a state that really, if I have it right, led to the what we would call at this moment the failure to become a fully fledged democracy.
And I think that the electoral process could have been better in Libya. I think they could have made better choices, more inclusive choices. They certainly shut out parties and women and more liberal groups from representation. But at the end of the day, you know, democratic design can do so much. But there are so many other factors putting pressure on a nation state that even the best constitution may fail. And Libya seems to be one of those cases where the pressures on the Libyan state today are so overwhelming. The actors coming in from the outside, whether they're Qatar or the Saudis or Europeans, are so fragmenting that its chances of survival are really quite slim.
Contrast that with Yemen, which you point out has better sort of state institutions and yet a kind of failed electoral process.
Yeah, I think Yemen is very difficult as well because of the multi layers of fragmentation. So, you know, Yemen is not just the north versus the south. It's tribal divisions, it's religious divisions, it's Al-Qaeda in the peninsula and ISIS now. The Houthi Shia minority have taken over part of the state. The Saudis are putting in huge amounts of money and also a bombing campaign. It is so fragmented that it's not clear how you pull that back to the center either. And even though it has a little bit more state capacity, it doesn't have natural resources. It doesn't really have gas or oil. It doesn't have a free flowing money supply to buy off people. So again, I would say, and I say this very, you know, sadly, because I've spent time in Yemen. I appreciate the people there and some of the courageous things that they've done. But Yemen to me looks like Syria in the sense of its propensity for continued war and collapse.
Let's talk about the places where this didn't happen, because I think that's as much of the story as the places where it did, in Saudi Arabia, for instance. I mean, why haven't we seen this in more places in the Middle East? Is there a way, through your analysis, to kind of get an answer to that?
Well, I mean, I think so far the places that you're right in the seed of the question, in that there were uprisings almost everywhere in North Africa and the Middle East. People took to the streets. They were complaining about food prices or lack of education or the police abuse. But only in a few places did those protests really rise to the level of challenging the state. The Saudis spent a lot of money on buying people off. They got cash payouts. They got better infrastructure. The Saudis reassured their citizenry that they were there for them by giving them money. The Bahrainis were supported by the Saudis, but at the same time, the Bahrainis also gave out money and resources. They assuaged some of the worst protests because they had the money to buy people off. I do think in Jordan and Morocco, there is a loyalty to the king, which can dampen down some of the most serious protests. And the Gulf states mostly are pretty much like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain in the sense that they're monarchies with oil wealth that they can use at those times of challenge. If you look at Syria, if you look at Tunisia, you don't have, and Yemen, you don't have that reservoir of money to buy people off, nor do you have that reservoir of goodwill because you're tied to the monarchy.
How do you see things turning out or moving forward? How do you imagine things might happen? Do you see more consolidation of power and a kind of return to the systems? Or is, are we on a path here, perhaps long and slow, to greater democracy? Big question, I know, about a very complicated region.
Well, I mean, I think you can, I tend to be optimistic. And when you meet some of the democratizing figures in these countries, you cannot be optimistic because of their incredible sacrifices and what they represent. But on the pessimistic side, you would look at the indicators across the board and say that the region in the last 4 years, after all the Arab Spring uprisings, has not become more democratic, apart from Tunisia. It stayed as undemocratic, without any real hope for democratization, almost everywhere outside of Tunisia. And there's nothing to really suggest that those places are going to radically change in the next few years to take out the Ansharan regimes, the powerful brokers, from their power bases today. But on the positive side, I mean, I think if you look at the broader arc of history, if you look at 1848 in Europe, if you look at Western European, the springtime of the peoples, you would say that initially, there were uprisings throughout much of Western Europe in the mid-19th century, and they mostly failed. Mm-hmm. You know, they fail in France. It fails partly in Germany. There's a few that grab hold in Scandinavia. But the Democrats taking to the streets in 19th century Europe failed. But they laid the seed for something that germinated and grew many, many decades later. So the spring times of the peoples in mid-19th century Europe now are the things we point back at as the moments that they began to move over 100, 200 years to democracy today. So on the positive side, the Arab world is now not the same. It's not the same as it was before 2011. People have broken off a psychological barrier about challenging their state. They now believe they can overthrow their leaders, and they believe that they can make something more democratic. They failed in many places the first time, but maybe they've laid the foundations for it happening again, and maybe there'll be more success.
Andy Reynolds, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Andy Reynolds, a political science professor at UNC Chapel Hill, co-author of The Arab Spring, Pathways of Repression and Reform. A week from today, by the way, I want to remind you, we're going to be at the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org, and also find out more about Andy's work. Same website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.